Okay, so first, let me thank the organizers. I mean, it's a wonderful opportunity to be back. I mean, I met Walter when I came here for a postdoc, and that was my first postdoc. That was actually September 1983, and it was so wonderful to feel so welcome and feel this human touch besides the great science that I had known about. So it was also a very unique time for the Institute because the Institute was sort of new and Jim Langer was around and Doug Scalapino, Bob Sugar, and the young postdoc. So it was really an exceptional time. Now, I have also a great intellectual debt to Walter. And as you'll see in my talk, the things that I've been working on over the last 15, 20 years, which is to try to make inroads in actually computing and predicting the properties of strongly correlated materials, which is a very difficult subject, is directly inspired and is really just a small little continuation of what Walter and his collaborators have done. So what I will do in my talk to convey that is I will sort of start by just reminding you a little bit of the seminal contribution of Walter to the field of solid state physics. I mean, he really enabled the first principle calculations in a field of materials when at the time it looked almost like an impossible task. People thought, well, there was really an exponential wall and it would be very difficult to compute anything. And now we sort of look around and in all the chemistry labs, people are now running density functional theory programs and people use them to find new topological insulators. So it was really his vision that made that into a reality. Then I will tell you a little bit about the difficulties with strongly correlated electrons and an approach which is the dynamical mean field theory which are following in order to advance in this field. And Walter always had great intellectual rigor. I mean, he was always close in touch with experiments. Maybe his visits to Bell Labs and that really is very important. So what I will do is I will show you how we are now using these methods in terms of trying to understand and predict properties of materials in something which is quite controversial, which is this recently discovered aronictites and chalcogenides, because that was sort of the first time that we could actually really test methods in real time. When these materials were discovered a few years ago, there was no available at the time a lot of experimental information, and the tools were almost quite ready to see what we can do. So that was sort of historically the first time that we had sort of working theory, working methods, and some very interesting strongly correlated material being discovered. So I'll show you a little bit of the successes and also maybe also a little bit of the failures of where we are in the field of correlated materials. And then I will go back and I'll show you that these two things are not so different after all, and that's sort of inspired by sort of a similar way of thinking, especially asking the questions, what is computable? What are the things which we can do in order to make contact with experiments? Because there are things that are not computable and sometimes are also not measured. And I think a lot of the wisdom is figuring out where we should go and what we should compute. And I will sort of stress this idea that what we're looking for in order to make progress in science is systems which are simple enough that we can actually solve them reliably, but at the same time are complex enough to capture the physics of what is seen experimentally. This is what I call reference systems. And I'll try to convince you that, well, we know by now that for weakly correlated materials, this system of Kohn-Sham equations is a good starting point for approaching the properties of a broad class of solids. I hope to convince you also that dynamical mean field theory and the associated mathematics that goes with it, which is an impurity model in a medium, is a good reference frame for thinking about strongly correlated electrons. So that's sort of the plan of my talk. And I should start to sort of with the very basics. When I got my PhD, I was sort of very strongly influenced by my advisor, Phil Anderson, who stressed that, well, we always have to look at the big principles because many things may not be computable. And it's certainly true in the field of correlated electrons, there are emergent phenomena. But there's also a lot of history that goes back into what we should be doing in science. And it goes to what Dirac was saying, that basically when we have quantum mechanics, in some sense we have a path towards reality. And people usually stay with the first part of the quote that we have quantum mechanics and therefore in principle everything is derivable, but they don't follow up with the second part of the quote, which I think is extraordinarily important. It's not enough that things are in principle derivable, but we need to find the methodologies which enable us to actually solve the problems, make contact with experiment, and make predictions. And it's here where really Walter pioneered this field and enabled us to understand some material, some broad range of materials, and it's sort of this path which I would like to explore in my talk, even though in the process we'll see some interesting emergent phenomena a la Anderson. Okay, so let's go back to the very beginning. There are two key papers in the density functional theory, in the foundations of the density functional theory. The first one of Hohenberg and Kohn, which says, well, there is a functional of the density whose extremization would give us the total energy of the solid and the extremum, the density of the solid. And this functional has two parts. One, which is explicitly the ionic potential. That's where the atoms enter, where you have the positions of the atom in your material. And another part, which is completely universal. It's good for all materials. And this is important because it opens a path, if we have good approximations to this functional, for getting properties of materials. And the second paper is the paper of Kohn and Sham, where in fact they introduce a very, very good algorithm for approximating this functional, which leads to the Kohn-Sham equations they will return to. And the idea is finding what to approximate inspired by the electron gas, and then finding a system of self-consistent equations, which gives us some fictitious particles, which in principle reproduce the density. And I will try to convince you that this is in fact a good approximation for many, many, many materials. So it turned out that there is these approximations were extraordinarily successful. Walter really spent a lot of time and intellectual energy in really trying to understand why. And I think this is a very important part of the education for what it is to be a physicist. It's not just getting the successful approximations, but also understanding why they work. And there is some short range in the bonding properties of matter that he stressed that are very important and will be very important through my talk. He really brought predictive power to material science. Now, structures of molecules, structures of solids, energies of formation, reaction pathways, possible composition of materials, all this can actually be computed using density functional theory, paving the way one day to actually having theory-guided material discovery, which is going to be extraordinarily important for society. And the reason for that is because we understand the method that therefore the errors are fairly systematic and can predict reliably material trends. And I'll go back in my talk to the importance of looking at trends rather than trying to predict a specific number. We want to take a class of a family of materials and see if we can actually understand how things are going. And then I will focus a lot on the results of the Kohn-Sham equations, which even though they are conceptually different from the Landau-Fermi liquid quasiparticles, that's really where we start for describing any weakly correlated material in practice. So, Steve already talked about lambda Fermi liquid, which is the foundation of weakly correlated systems. He explained already that if we sort of integrate out degrees of freedom and we go to low enough energy, the interactions go away, and we can use free electrons in molecular fields to describe the physics in that scale. But that didn't tell us how we compute these things. That's where a different approach, which is these Kohn-Sham equations, come in. Well, this set of equations was designed to give us the density of the system, provided that we know this this Kohn-Sham potential. It turns out that in practice, when the systems in the materials that we call weakly correlated systems, where lambda theory holds in a broad energy range, this system of equations is not that, even for the excitations. In the following sense, if we just take this Kohn-Sham-Green's function, if we just take this free system as the starting point, and we start doing perturbation theory, the many-body perturbation theory, in the Screen-Coulomb interactions, and because here we added a potential, we need to take it out, it turns out that this correction is not so large and is systematic. So just to give you an example, this is sort of all the gaps of all the semiconductors, these tons of materials. This is the result in red of the LDA. This is what happens when you put the first correction in the Screen-Coulomb interactions. So at least for some set of materials, we know what we're doing, and we can actually get a controlled approach to the electronic structure. And many things have been computed with this. The problem, of course, is that in strongly correlated materials, this thing breaks down because the perturbation theory actually doesn't converge. This is the things that Steve also talked about. They're very interesting because you have phenomena which are not weak perturbations of the band theory. So that's basically where we want to go. And we have all sorts of abnormal things, like he already mentioned, high resistivities in a normal state, high temperature superconductivity, and many other things which can be even more useful than semiconductor physics. And this Kohn-Sham system plus perturbation theory around them, we know that it cannot describe their spectroscopic properties for a very simple reason. When we look at the spectra of the strongly correlated materials, we see clear atomic signatures. Somehow, in the energy range that we're studying these materials, they remember that they come from atoms. And therefore, it's not approachable via perturbation theory in those bands because that spectra is not smoothly connected. So that sort of was pointed out by Sir Neville Mott, and it was clear in the community that what we need is something else to start describing the properties of correlated materials, another reference system, which is, again, simple enough so that eventually we can solve it, but it has to contain both the band physics and the atomic physics. And that's sort of the motivation for the dynamic mean field theory. And the idea here is, like in any mean field theory, what we want to do is, we want it, like in the Ising model, we want to take a model of many, many, many degrees of freedom and replace it by a mean field. But the problem is that we have a quantum problem. For example, we have a Haber model, which is a simple atom, which has only s electrons, so it can be only in three different states, up, down, double occupied. So we need to actually understand the idea, what is a medium for a quantum system. But the idea is very obvious. I mean, the single site is the atom, and the medium has to be a reservoir of electrons, which has to enable the atom to change the valence when it explores all the possible quantum mechanical configurations. So mathematically, we have something like Haber model, and we want to replace it by what's called an Anderson impurity model, which is an atom in a medium, and the parameters in this medium have to be optimized so as to be the best possible mean field. So here we have this, and then there is a self-consistency condition which tells you how to choose this mean field. Very good. So now, what have we achieved? Well, we have now a quantum problem. What we do is sort of first truncate it to an atom in a medium, and then we get all sorts of information from the atom. So we can get, for example, a self-energy. we can get, for example, irreducible vertices. Since it's an atom, we just get sort of local quantities, but then we need to embed them. So you should think of this as a quantum embedding. You first truncate the problem to an atom, and then you embed the quantities to get the full, to get the quantities which are measured in experiment. This is what replaces sort of the bands in a many-body system, is the one-particle Green's function. This is what's measured in neutron scattering, is actually the spin susceptibility. So we use this as a medium to generate all the observables. Very good. And then basically, to go to the real electronic structure of materials, we need to take one even bigger leap. Now our Hilbert space is a lot bigger because now we have a lot more electrons. We move away from the Hubbard model, and now we're dealing with real solids. But we recognized that density functional theory was already treating very well all the states which are sufficiently extended. So we can actually apply the correlations only to the outer shell of the very strongly correlated ones. So now we do a very specific quantum embedding into the interacting shell, and the rest we replace by something like an effective Kohn-Sham potential. That's what's called now LDA plus DMFT, and it's going to be the main tool that we'll use to explore the ironic tides. So there are still some parameters, but those parameters can either be kept fixed across a chemical series, or they can also be computed from first principles. So now, when we go here, it's becoming an ab initio method. We don't need to know the experimental results to make some prediction about what's going to happen. And what I'd like to tell you is the story of how this thing fared when the iron nictites came along, because that's basically what keeps us honest, seeing how well we do vis-a-vis experiments. So, but before I go into the results, I think that there's something which are important. I mean, this is a reference system because it takes something which is very complicated, the strongly correlated material, and reduces it to something local. So now we have something much simpler to analyze. So when we get results which agree with the experiment, we can actually really understand them because we have a problem which is sufficiently simple, which describes all the strong correlation physics. Another thing that we'll explain maybe later on is that all these equations can be derived, just like the density functional theory, by writing suitable functionals to compute the free energy. And then I should stress that this has been work over many years, and there's been continuous advance over 20 years for finding better methods by many different groups for solving the DMFT equations. One thing which is common to the density functional theory, the derivation I gave you clearly targets local quantities. It's like a mean field theory to compute local dynamical observables. But once we have them, we can get other things from the method. And even though we don't have a rigorous right to interpret them as given by correctly by the method, they actually turn out to be quite good, as I will show in a moment. Those are the k-dependent quantities. Also, I should stress that this local Green's function or local self-energy is the minimal object that captures the physics of strong correlations in the following sense. If we start from sort of the LDA, we start from the Kohn-Sham Green's function or the Kohn-Sham self-energy, it's a very local potential in space-time. Then in semiconductors, when we put the first corrections, we get some of the spatial non-locality that comes from the unscreened Coulomb interactions. But if you really want to describe MOD physics, we need to abandon locality in time. That's why we need very, very strongly frequency-dependent objects, and that's enough to describe MOD physics. Now, is this reliable? For a long time, we didn't know. The only thing we knew is that this method becomes exact by construction if we take in a very intelligent way the limit of large coordination. If we scale the kinetic energy by the square root of the coordination so that these two terms, kinetic energy and on-site repulsion, can compete, then we get dynamical mean field theory. But this, the world has three dimensions, and how do we, many materials are quasi-two-dimensional. How do we know if and when this approach is okay? Well, now it's becoming possible to enlarge the size of the cluster, and then we can see whether the approach is converging. But in real materials, this is still quite tough. So ultimately, just like in density functional theory, at the end of the day, the quality of the method we judge by seeing what we can predict. And if the predictions look good, we say this is encouraging, even though I stress that it's going to become soon very possible to make this into something quite systematic in the sense that we can enlarge the size of the Hilbert space and see if things change or not. Okay, so now let me tell you about actual results and a little bit of how it fared. These materials were discovered in 2008. They're iron-based, they're superconducting, they were completely unexpected, and they are now a large family of these materials. So there's very, very nice playground for theory. And immediately after the discovery, the methods could be tested. What did the theory predict? Well, first, it could not be electron-phonon coupling in the sense that the standard density functional theory calculation for the electron-phonon coupling, which is quite reliable, gave very low TC. But there was something that was not measured at the time, which was that these materials are correlated in the sense that the mass or the renormalization or the band velocity relative to del dA was considerably enhanced of the order of 3 to 5 times. So this, it was sort of a something that was not known, and sort of like some guidance how to orient ourselves vis-a-vis these compounds. And well, eventually this was measured about a year later in 2009, and it was established that the mass renormalization was a factor of 3. This is 1 over the mass renormalization relative to the LDA. So this, at least this suggestion that these materials are correlated with an enhancement of 3 to 5 was actually correct. So now we can start seeing that having first principle methods is very important, because at that time people were writing models or trying to see how to model the material, how bands there could be. It's something very satisfying where one can actually put the atoms and say something when the experimental information is not available. And again, that was something that in solid state physics was really introduced by Walter Kohn. Now, where does this correlation come from? So this is the real surprise. In simulations, one can change parameters. Of course, the atom has one parameter, but we can change what happens. And what we found is that this correlation is entirely driven by the Hund's coupling. This is a toy model of the material, but it's U we take here very large. We vary the Hund's coupling, and we can go from 0 resistivity to resistivities way above the Mott limit. Now, experiment. Now we can make materials, well, we, the experimentalists, can make materials which are very remarkable. This is potassium iron 2 arsenic 2. I want to stress that the resistivity here is below 1 microohm centimeter. So this is much purer than copper. So this is a very, very pure material. But if you look at the resistivities at high temperatures, at room temperature, is around 500 microohm centimeters. This is 5 times the Mott resistivity. So here the wave concept makes absolutely no sense. So this is indeed a remarkable, very strongly correlated material. And we believe that we now understand the mechanism behind this correlation. And this is not Mott-Haber physics. This is not charge blocking, because these materials are good metals. But it's entirely due to this Hund's coupling. The other thing which is remarkable about these methods is that we can actually take now all these materials in these families and understand how the correlation strength, how this mass enhancement evolves, and tie it to the structure. So here what we're changing, when we go from all these compounds which have iron nictide layers but other fillings, what we're changing is actually the nictogen height. And one can see how the mass enhancement evolves. both orbital by orbital. Some of them are measured, and those are sort of the stars from experiments. Others had not been at the time. So in principle, it's something we can predict. We can see what the experiment gives, and we can come back and start iterating theory and experiment. And this only becomes feasible in the last few years. So this is really a new development in condensed matter of correlated materials to be able to do such a thing. Now, of course, density functional theory for a broad class of systems showed us the way in which direction we had to go, because this is routine for semiconductors, as I showed you before. But for correlated materials, this level of calculations was unprecedented. And it's not just restricted to photoemission. This is recent work on actually predicting the neutron scattering spectra, where you, the spectra of spin fluctuations, where you shoot neutrons and you try to see what's inside the sample. And this is across all the families of ironictites, where you see some black dots is because measurements already existed. There are places where there were no measurements, where, like for example, the iron selenide that was only done on the last year. And the predictions are surprisingly good, and there are lots of things for people to measure. Again, this is not expected to be exact. We do expect that there are going to be some errors at low energies. But all of a sudden, we have a tool which orients us in this huge space of materials where we can actually do something just using the atomic positions, like Walter Kahn told us that we had to do. Okay, so now qualitative things. So I'll explain in a second the physics of this Hund's metal, why we see what we see. But let me show you a direct prediction from for experiments that we made. We said that if we observe very carefully at a photoemission, and this is theoretical photoemission, it's done in the computer, not in real experiments, along near the gamma point, there is a pocket of XY character, and here we see a band crossing. When we raise the temperature, this thing is completely gone. So this is the incoherence-incoherence crossover, and shows that this idea of rigid bands doesn't make sense in strongly correlated materials, because here there's nothing, there's no band. The bands in density functional theory stays there at all temperatures. Here the bands come and go. And this is sort of experiments at very low temperatures in lithium iron arsenide, but many groups have done that in other materials. At low temperatures, you clearly see a crossing. Then as you start raising the temperature, this crossing starts going away. When we get close to room temperature, there's nothing left. So this is sort of a qualitative prediction of the theory of these states, which magically evanesce as you go to high temperatures. And again, all that was done without really any input from the experiment. So now, and I should say the first observation of that was done by the group of Ziyech Shen in a different material. So now, what's going on here? This reference system is a little bit more complicated than the conscience system, because we have an impurity model in a subconsistent medium, but we can analyze it and try to understand the process of forming those quasiparticles. And basically, we can start at the very high energy scale, we can start with the atomic degrees of freedom, and we can see how these things start binding to the fermions at different energy scales and end up at very low temperatures below 20 Kelvin with a nice system of quasiparticles. And of course, for this, we can sort of write effective Hamiltonians to make a story of how the quasiparticle degrees of freedom get formed. What's unique to these families of ironictites, what we call the orbital spin separation, is that there is a regime where the orbitals are already absorbed. They are completely itinerant, but the spins are completely free, which is why we see them as localized excitations in the spin fluctuation spectra. And that's sort of the regime where these materials operate, and this is the scale where the quasiparticle is visible in the photoemission. Because if you want to see an electron in photoemission, you need to recombine everything, the orbital and the spin. But it's a metal because the charge on the orbital is always very itinerant. Okay, so now let me sort of finalize by showing you very briefly why, after all, density functional theory and dynamic mean field theory have a very, very common structure. And the existence of functionals is very clear. I mean, we can select some observable, and we can always do Legendre transforms and express the free energy in terms of the observable. So the existence of a functional is clear. The great genius of Walters was to realize that it was the density, the right variable for the weakly correlated materials. Now, also the universality comes from the fact that the crystal potential couples linearly to the density, so in the action, so therefore the functional will contain a universal and non-universal part. And in fact, all the methods for electronic structure differ in the choice of variable. The Bain-Cardano functional uses a full Green's function. Density functional theory uses the density. Spin density functional uses rho up, rho down. In dynamic mean field theory, what we use is the local Green's function of some orbital. And this machinery, which starts with the Hohenberg-Kohn paper, can be used also to derive DFT plus the combination of density functional theory and dynamic mean field theory. So there is a unifying structure behind the two methods. Also, constructing approximations it turns out to be quite similar. I mean, what we learned from the Kohn-Sham paper is that we have to break the free energy in two parts. One part, which is in some sense some sort of kinetic energy, which is a zeroth order thing, plus a correction, and that we need to approximate the correction in an intelligent way. So the free part is just the kinetic energy, which is basically written in this way using Lagrange multipliers. And the important thing is that the correlation energy should not be computed in perturbation theory. What we learned from the Kohn-Sham paper is that we should just take the uniform electron gas at a fixed density, which is the local approximation, and write that as our approximation for the exact functional. Now, in dynamic mean field theory, we do exactly the same. We break our free energy as a functional of the local Green's function into two parts. One, which is entirely analogous to the Kohn-Sham free energy. It has essentially the same mathematical form. It's the zeroth order in a perturbation expansion in the interactions at fixed observable, fixed local Green's function. And for the second part, we just follow the Kohn-Sham paper, except that we take the opposite limiting case. Instead of taking the exchange and correlation free energy from the electron gas, we simply take it as a sum of the isolated atoms. But in spirit, it's exactly the same. I mean, those two equations look remarkably similar. They're both local approximations. They just differ a little bit in their character, what is really isolated. Here is the atom. Here is actually the uniform electron gas, point by point. So those are two different notions of locality, but they are two local approximations. So now the conclusions in my last 5 minutes. I introduced dynamic mean field theory as a reference frame. What is the big difference? The main point is this is non-Gaussian. An impurity model contains interactions. When you take quasi-particles and start doing perturbation theory around them, you start with the Gaussian. Here, we're starting with something which is highly non-Gaussian. So you already, your starting point already has a ton of physics which is not describable in a Gaussian framework. So I think this is the key advance or the key recognition. If you want to describe correlated materials, your zeroth order is not a Gaussian. The second point is that I try to convince you that it gives you some zeroth order picture of many things we see in strongly correlated materials. I focus mostly on the normal state. It's still a challenge now to go one order of magnitude lower in temperature and see how this correlated normal state evolves into a superconductor. But to me, it's clear through the discovery of the iron nictides that there are several routes which we can use to treat strong correlations. This is something which is not agreed in the community. Many people think there's just only one way to go to strongly correlated physics. This classification in terms of impurity models shows you that the field is much richer. There are multiple routes which are realized in different families of materials. I also try to convince you that we have something which is like a temperature-dependent electronic structure, and the reorganization of the degrees of freedom is highly non-local in energy, and that's, again, something which took me a very long time to come to terms with, because I was sort of brought up in the Anderson-Wilson school of renormalization group, that you go scale by scale, and the changes energy scale by energy scale are local. Here we see things which are highly non-local, these things that come and go as a function of temperature, those bands that disappear, those transfer spectral weight over broad energy scales, over scales of NEV, it's hard to rationalize in a simple Wilsonian picture. And for the outlook, but it's all captured by this local framework of the MFT. Following again, Kohn's legacy, we definitely need to construct more accurate functionals. In density functional theory, this was an effort of many years. Now the chemical accuracy of these functionals has improved a great deal. And once you have a more accurate tool, you can make more accurate predictions. I think also we need to continue, inspired by Walter, with a deep analysis of the many-body theory which underlies those functionals. That's something that Walter did over many years, and I think it's very, very important direction that needs to be followed also in the context of these strongly correlated materials. In terms of applications, I think that this is just beginning. Now people are beginning to use dynamical mean field theory to study correlation effects on surface, on interfaces, on defects. And again, we've seen how big of a field eventually in density functional theory took. I think that there is really lots of interesting correlation effects in complex systems. And I believe also that in due time, it will also enable the discovery of new materials in the field of correlated electron systems. I think we still need deeper understanding of the solutions of these DMFT equations. So this is a simple framework, but still, even the renormalization group flow, the RG metal, took several years to understand, and it's quite complicated. I think that there's a lot of room for technical advances, but clearly we're there in terms of having a handshake with experiment. And I think these iron nictites and chalcogenides was the first real-time test of the method, and I think it passed really with flying colors. We're still not there in that we don't fully understand how the superconductivity comes about. And I think this is a challenge for the next few years. But let me end with some perspective on DFT and just tell people that they have to be patient. I mean, the best theory that we have in solid state physics is still the BCS theory. But there is this famous say by Bernd Mathias that BCS tells us everything but finds us nothing. And it's true in the sense that for a long time, all the materials were found by serendipity, and this Zach Fiske always reminds me that there's actually not even a break in the slope around the BCS theory. It's also true about the DFT framework. I mean, it was established in the 60s and still there would not produce any change in the material discovery. But you have to give things time, and it took many years for this framework, this conceptual framework, to become a reality in the sense that people actually took actual codes and make them sufficiently user-friendly, and the computers got to be good enough that many people could use it to do structural optimization in a broad range of materials. And then eventually, in the last year, this thing bears fruit, and this material, the hydrogen sulfide, which is now a 200 Kelvin superconductor, this is the record superconductor, has really shown that all this effort was worthwhile, because this material was actually suggested by theory. The experimentalist in this huge space of materials knew exactly where to look, where the electron-phonon coupling was strong, the vibrations were high, and they acknowledged properly the theory. And this, actually, the density functional theory of Walter Kohn and his collaborators was essential, was the foundation that many years down the line enabled that very important discovery. So the message is that there is really time for things to mature, and we have to be patient in terms of fostering the people to continue developing methods. And Walter was great in that respect. Now, there's another reason why we have to continue working in this area, and this goes to one of the things that Feynman left on his blackboard. I'm done. And he wrote, among other things, that the only thing that he understands are things that he can create. What I can create, I do not understand. And really, that's something that will convince us that we really understand strongly correlated materials when we can actually design them. And the path to do that was laid down by Walter Kohn and his collaborators. Thank you for your attention.
Is there any work or you've thought about doing time-dependent work with dynamic images?
Yes, yes, yes. That's very interesting. And of course, it's one more dimension to keep track of, because we need, but what Lou is saying is that yes, we could try to model materials out of equilibrium just by adding g of tt prime, and there are many people which are working in this area. Jim Freericks, for example, extended the dynamic of field equations to out of equilibrium situations, and that's another direction in which one can try to follow your excitonic ideas and try to find really new materials by shining light on them. So this field is actually extremely open and extremely exciting.
Gabby, so the DMFT is working rather well for these strongly correlated materials, but I just wanted to make sure I understood something or didn't misunderstand something that you said. Of course, for the strongly correlated materials, density functional theory, in a sense, works just fine. It's the approximations that fail.
Well, what I try to distinguish is two aspects of it. One is the energetics. Density functional theory is great for energetics. But in correlated materials, we're mostly interested in spectra. We spend all the time doing theoretical and experimental spectroscopies. And there, the only thing we have is the Kohn-Sham system. And then we can compare the Kohn-Sham system with the real spectra, and we see no way in which we can make those two things to correspond, because they look extraordinarily different. So
absolutely,
rather than continue doing perturbation theory in there, we just say, okay, we give up, we're gonna find some other reference system which is a little bit richer because it has the atom built in there, and we will perturb around that. But I agree with you, in terms of energetics, there's really room for finding, because structural optimization is very hard. So if we can find good, accurate functionals that can give me the correct volume of thermal expansion of plutonium, I would be very happy, because it doesn't come out well in DFT, and I'm sure that variations or better functionals or your machine learning or something, I see no reason why the energetics may not eventually come out right. So we agree there. It's just that we care so much about spectra that
exactly,
we need to start from other things.
Exactly. Thank you.
Okay. I think time's getting short, so let's thank Gabby.